Chapter 40, I think. Yes. And if we were to go by the schedule that I predicted, we would finish Genesis in this session and the next combined. However, there are 11 chapters to cover before the end of the book, and therefore I'm not going to make an effort to finish it in two sessions. If we need three, that's what we'll take. That's one thing I want to do differently this year. All other years we've had a tight schedule, had to finish at a certain time, and there's no flexibility. And what usually ends up happening is that I end up giving short shrift to those very interesting prophecies in chapter 49, just because by the time I get there, I'm already a session late in finishing Genesis and have 5 minutes left to finish whatever session I'm in. So we're just not going to be rushed, but we will move along as quickly as I can without compromising the treatment. In chapter 37 of Genesis, we saw that Joseph was sold by his brothers to some nomadic merchants who were Ishmaelites and Midianites, and they took him down to Egypt, and they sold him into the home of a man named Potiphar, where he was quickly recognized as an incredibly gifted and blessed young man, and was quickly rose to a position of responsibility among other slaves there, and eventually was the steward of the entire house. And the Pharaoh himself, excuse me, the Potiphar himself, trusted him so thoroughly that he gave him the total unaccountable reign over all of his household goods. And we're told that Potiphar himself didn't even know what was with him in the house except the food that was put before him at every meal. That is to say, he didn't even look at the inventories. He just trusted Joseph with everything. And rightly so. Joseph was trustworthy in everything. There was one situation, though, that arose where Joseph's trustworthiness was certainly challenged. And that was where Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. He very nobly and heroically resisted all of her overtures. But she eventually got frustrated with his non-compliance and accused him falsely of trying to take advantage of her. When Potiphar was told of this, it made him angry, though, as I pointed out last time in verse 19 of chapter 39, it does not say that he was angry at Joseph, and it's probable that his anger was not toward Joseph. It was probably toward his wife, because I suspect that his wife's character being what it was, and him living with his wife, and Joseph's character being what it was, and Potiphar knowing him well also, it was probable that Potiphar believed Joseph's story more than he believed his wife's, but he could not. It would just be unthinkable for a man to accept the testimony of a slave against his own wife or against a free person at all. It would just be culturally unallowable, and so Potiphar had no choice but to act as if there was some merit in the accusation. And so he had to put Joseph in prison. This, as I pointed out, was a very mild punishment. If Potiphar had in any sense believed his wife's accusations, then Joseph, of course, would have been put to death. But he was put in prison, which indicates that Potiphar didn't really believe what his wife said about him, but he had to do something. He had to take some token action. And this is probably what made Potiphar angry, is that he was deprived, by his wife putting him in this position, he was deprived of one of his best servants, certainly his best servant. Now Joseph is in prison, and we find that things happen to him in prison that parallel pretty much what happened to him in Potiphar's house initially. That is, at the end of chapter 39, we read that Joseph, the Lord was with Joseph in prison. We had read at the beginning of chapter 39 that the Lord was with him in Egypt in Potiphar's house. We find that the Lord caused everything that Joseph did to prosper, so that he was noticed as being competent and good, and the keeper of the prison elevated him to a position of authority over all the other prisoners. Of course, he was still a prisoner himself, but he was there must have been ranks of trust and responsibility that were given to various prisoners, and Joseph achieved the highest rank early on. And so it was that he was in a position to encounter two of Pharaoh's chief officials. As we know from having read the whole story, this encounter in chapter 40 eventually is that which led to his being released and elevated to great authority. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt, And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison, in the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Now, it's interesting that Joseph was actually in authority over all the prisoners. In verse 22 of the previous chapter, it says that the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners. And in verse 23, it says that he didn't look to anything that was under Joseph's hand because the Lord was with him. Joseph was really kind of the chief among the prisoners, but he served the prisoners because that is, of course, as Jesus pointed out, what true leadership is service. Jesus himself washed his disciples' feet and said, I am your Lord, I am your master, but I, your Lord and master, wash your feet and be as a servant among you. He said, I want you to do the same. Now, the butler was really the cup bearer, the wine bearer for the king in ancient times, and maybe in modern times for all I know about modern monarchies, I know very little. A king would not eat his food until it had been tasted by somebody else who was more expendable, just in case. You never know when somebody might try to poison the king, someone malicious toward him for some decree he made that affected their family badly, or some enemy from another country wanting to gain an advantage might try to poison the king, assassinate him. And therefore, there were people who would screen the food and drink before the king would eat or drink it. And this butler was like Nehemiah. Nehemiah, at a later date, was the cupbearer or the butler for another king, the king of Persia, Xerxes. Ahasuerus, as he's also known. It was Artaxerxes. Nehemiah was the cupbearer for Artaxerxes, the Persian king. And that meant that as he would bring the wine to the king, he would sample it in the king's presence. He would take a drink of it before he'd give it to the king. And that would be to, of course, see whether there was anything dead in the drink. If the servant fell over dead who drank it, then the king, of course, would probably go without that night. But if the servant was not harmed by drinking it, it was assumed that it was safe for the king as well. And so there was the butler who had that role. The baker, I think we all know what a baker is. But these were the chief butler and the chief baker, which means that in a household like that of Pharaoh's, there must have been a lot of servants in the kitchen. But there was one man in particular over the bakery, over the making of bread and so forth and pastries. The other man was over the wine and the drink service. And they were both, it says they both offended their lord the king, though it doesn't say in what way they offended him. As it turns out, his birthday was coming up. We see that in verse 20 later in this chapter. A few days after these men were put in prison, 3 days later, or after they dreamed, it was the Pharaoh's birthday. That may have something to do with why they were arrested in the first place. Furthermore, we know that as things turned out, the butler ended up being repositioned in his position of authority, whereas the baker ended up being hanged. These two men were arrested at the same time, but one was acquitted of all charges and restored to his office. The other was found guilty and hanged. Knowing these things, we can perhaps read a little between the lines, and we may not be 100% correct, but it is probably relatively safe to say that some impropriety with reference to the king's meals was discovered in the house. Perhaps some poison was found in the kitchen. And it was not yet known who was responsible. The king's birthday was coming up within a few days, and perhaps somebody was planning to poison him at his birthday, but it was not known who the conspirators were. And so the men in charge of both departments, of the drink and the food, were both thrown in prison until their cases could be heard, until such time as they could discover who might be responsible for this thing. As it turns out, it would appear that the butler was vindicated. One would expect the butler to be innocent, since he'd have to drink the wine before the king does anyway. It's hard to imagine how he would have a part in a plot to poison the king. The baker was hanged, and apparently he was found guilty of some kind of a plot. This is probable. We don't know. We don't have the scripture telling us this whole scenario. But what we do know is that a few days before the king's birthday, two of his chief culinary officers were thrown in prison, and both of them were brought out of prison the same day, several days later. One was hanged and the other was restored to office. The assumption is that some crime was committed, of which they're probably both suspected. And when the hearings and trial or whatever took place, one was found innocent, the other guilty. Since he was executed, and since they were related to the king's food, both of them, it may be that there was some kind of a plot, as I say, uncovered, that they were suspected of poisoning the king or trying to poison the king. In any case, we read on. They happened to be in contact with Joseph. And the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came in to them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" Well, that's a strange question to ask somebody who who's in prison. Why are you so sad? You know, well, what's to be happy about in a third world jail? I mean, sleeping with the rats on the damp floor every night. I mean, who could be happy? Well, Joseph apparently didn't consider that was grounds for being grumpy. You know, Joseph was a prisoner for, as far as he knows, for life. There was not a term attached. He did it. He was accused of a crime, which should have gotten the death penalty had he been guilty. But he probably just got indefinite imprisonment for the rest of his life. And here he is, a prisoner as far as he knows forever. He's going to live and grow old and die in this prison. And yet he thinks it's strange that they don't have a happy face when they're in similar circumstances. It's clear that Joseph was able to stay above the circumstances and encourage his fellow prisoners when they were getting down in the dumps. He didn't know why initially they were sad, and he asked them. And they said to him, "We have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "Behold, in my dream a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. And it was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days the Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler." Now, Joseph had had prophetic dreams himself, you recall. He had had two dreams. In fact, all the dreams in Genesis seem to come, or at least in Joseph's story, come in doubles. He had a dream of his sheaves and his brother's sheaves being gathered together in the field, and his brother's sheaves bowed down to his. Then he had another dream of similar meaning, which was that all the sun and 11 stars bowed down to him. In other words, both dreams had to do with his family honoring him and revering him and him being in authority over them. God gave him two dreams for it. At a later point in chapter 41, Pharaoh is going to have two dreams, different from each other, but both with the same meaning. Now we have two men have dreams, and although their meanings are not the same, there are similar characteristics to each of them. Joseph is acquainted with the phenomenon of dreams. Though we are not told that he had ever interpreted any dreams prior to this, and he may not have known whether God would give him the interpretation or not. He just was possibly curious to hear it, and maybe God would tell him what it meant. And sure enough, God did reveal to him. He said that this was a dream of that the butler would be vindicated within 3 days and be restored to his old office. And it says in verse 14, "But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me and make mention of me to the Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." Now, Joseph probably saw this as a real divine appointment, and he was right in doing so, because here, Joseph, his only hope of ever getting out of prison and being restored back to his family, which is all he cared about at this point, he didn't care about the things that later would happen because he couldn't anticipate them, but just going home to his family is all he wanted, but he had no hope unless he would have some kind of an advocate with a high authority. Probably no one could override Potiphar, who is the captain of the guards of the Pharaoh, who had put him in prison, or Potiphar's wife, short of the Pharaoh himself. What Joseph is hoping for is an opportunity to appeal to Caesar, as Paul did, you know, to appeal to the highest authority, like take his case before the Supreme Court, because the lower courts he'd been condemned probably without a trial, just on accusation. But the only person who could override his earlier condemnation was the Pharaoh, and now he sees the hand of God in his, hey, here's a couple of Pharaoh's officers with me. Now, he wouldn't know initially that that would work for his good, but once he realized, God showed him, this butler's going to be going back to the Pharaoh's house. This man has contact with the Pharaoh on a daily basis. He's a trusted official. When he's restored, if he speaks on my behalf to Pharaoh, this is my ticket out of here. And in fact, it turned out that it was, but two things were different than what he thought. First of all, his ticket out of there was not a ticket back home to Palestine, to his family. It was a ticket to the throne. He became, you know, second only to Pharaoh in authority in Egypt, just as he had become in Potiphar's house or in the prison, at the highest position available for any man to occupy. But there was another disappointment for him. I mean, I'm not sure that that was a disappointment, but the second thing certainly was, and that was that although the butler did become his ticket out of prison, it was a full 2 years after this dream was had before the butler even remembered to speak to Pharaoh about him. So 2 years is a long time when you're rotten in a third world jail. I mean, 2 years is a very long time. These days, some people think they're a long-term missionary if they spend 2 years on the mission field. That's not really long-term, but to spend the same time in a jail, it really feels like a long time. Well, Joseph, of course, realizes somehow that this man is an opportunity for him to get the attention of the Pharaoh and possibly to have his case heard before Pharaoh and possibly be vindicated and released and go home. So he tells this man, when Pharaoh restores you to office, please remember me, speak for me, and implying, you know, please ask the Pharaoh to hear my case so that I can be vindicated and get out of here. Verse 16, when the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, I also was in my dream, and there I had three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head. So Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days the Pharaoh will lift off your head. Actually, literally lift up your head, the same expression that was used in verse 13 of the butler, but with a different meaning in this case. The Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. It's like the birds in the dream ate the pastries off his head. They're going to actually eat his flesh as his corpse is hanging on a tree. Now, that'd be a hard word to give a guy, it seems to me. You know, I mean, especially after he got his hopes up. When he heard the other guy got a good message in his dream, this guy thought, well, maybe I'll get a good message too. Instead, it's about as bad as it can get. But notice in both cases, the dreams had things in common with each other. Both of them had to do with 3 days. One had three branches that represented 3 days. The other had three baskets that represented 3 days. And both of them, Joseph perhaps as a play on words, he could say to each of them, you're both going to have your head lifted up in 3 days. One of them, his head was lifted up in the sense that he was exalted back to position. That's a normal Hebraism in Scripture. I don't know whether the Egyptians were familiar with it. Joseph apparently was, because he used it. But David used the same expression in a well-known psalm, which is Psalm 3, and verse 3, where David says, but you, O Lord, are the shield for me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. Now, lifts up my head means elevates me to position of authority. That's just a Hebraism, a Hebrew idiom. And that's what Joseph meant by it when he said it to the butler. The Pharaoh is going to lift up your head. He's going to restore you. He's going to elevate you to office, to your former place of authority. But he found occasion to use the same expression with the butler who's going to be hanged. Well, he's going to lift up your head too, but in an entirely different sense. Now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand again. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And we find in chapter 41, verse 1, that forgetting was a lapse of memory that lasted this butler 2 full years. Now, for the butler, that time might not have taken very long in passing. He was in the royal house, enjoying royal comforts. But that same 2 years, Joseph was wondering, is there going to be any news? You know, listening, keeping his ear to the door every time someone came in, see if that was a messenger from the Pharaoh calling for him to come and hear his case. But 2 years is a long time when you're waiting in a damp dungeon. You know, Joseph is a wonderful example of suffering with a Christian disposition, a Christian attitude. The Lord was with him, but he wasn't with him in very comfortable circumstances. And Joseph maintained a rather cheerful aspect, whatever condition he was in. He was always thankful. He was always mindful of the things he had in his favor. When Pharaoh's wife was trying to seduce him, he didn't say, "Boy, am I in a terrible situation." He says, my master's put everything under my hands except you. And, of course, you're his wife. I shouldn't have you." But he was recalling all the privileges he'd been giving. Here he's a slave, and what he thinks of are the privileges he's had, rather than grumbling about what he's been deprived of. And in the prison, he thinks it's strange that people are sad in the prison. And yet he's there with a life sentence, as far as he knows. So, here we have an example of a man who, with very excellent attitude and disposition, endured a great number of sufferings. If you would catalog from the beginning of the story the amount of suffering that Joseph went through, it's of all kinds. Practically any kind of suffering you or I have experienced would be in the list. He was resented by his family, his brothers. So he was the unpleasant end of sibling rivalry. They didn't ever speak kindly to him. He was always spoken harshly to. I guess in a marriage today, when that happens, they call that emotional abuse. I don't know that I like the term emotional abuse, because it sounds like a crime or something. Of course, it's not right to treat someone that way, but I've heard people divorce their husbands or wives because of what they call emotional abuse, which, as far as I know, is just verbal. And I don't deny that words can hurt. Sticks and stones break bones, and words hurt even deeper than that. But being spoken unkindly to and never being spoken peacefully to, of course it's discouraging. Of course it's hurt your feelings. But Joseph had that in his family. His brothers could never speak peaceably to him. Then they sold him after really planning to kill him. He was exiled from his family. He was reduced to the status of a slave after being in a wealthy household where he was the heir of all things, where he was to receive the birthright of a wealthy house. He now is a slave, without any hope of ever inheriting anything. And he was, of course, falsely accused by his master's wife. False accusation is a hard thing to suffer, especially when there's just no way that you can be vindicated and you know you're innocent. He was, of course, put in prison, a very hard place to be. Short of dying, a life sentence in a third world prison is about as bad a situation as a man could be subjected to. We didn't read this in Genesis, but in Psalm 105, we read that when he was imprisoned, he was chained painfully in shackles. It says in Psalm 105 something about this when it's talking about Joseph's imprisonment. Psalm 105 and verse 18. Verse 17-18 says, "He sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons." And verse 19 says, "Until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. The king sent and released him. The ruler of the people let him go free." But it mentions that they hurt his feet with fetters and laid him in irons. That's something we didn't read about in Genesis, but apparently that would obviously be not only humiliating but also painful. Then, of course, he had the additional thing of that he had helped somebody, he'd encouraged somebody, he had ministered to somebody, and then they forget him. They forget him and leave him to rot. That's a rather painful experience too. And so he has to wait for 2 more years in prison for no good reason, just because of the forgetfulness of this man who owed him a favor. Well, We read of the remedying of that situation in chapter 41. Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then, behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking fat cows. So Pharaoh awoke. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on 1 stalk, plump and good. Then, behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh woke, and indeed it was a dream. It'd be kind of hard to picture that, but things often happen in dreams that are kind of surrealistic and they're kind of hard to explain. And even after you wake up, think, how did that happen? I don't remember how that progression actually occurred. But I wonder what it would look like, 7 skinny cows eating 7 fat cows. First of all, cows don't generally eat meat, but furthermore, their mouths aren't big enough to just swallow them whole like a crocodile or something. I wonder how that looked. Must have been kind of a grotesque dream. And then, of course, even weirder is 7 blasted ears of grain eating 7 plump ears of grain. Strange, bizarre kinds of dreams. However, we know, of course, that when Joseph interpreted it, that it has to do with famine coming. And it's surprising that Pharaoh's wise men, when consulted about these dreams, were not able to figure that out. I'm not saying that I would have figured it out, but I'm not a wise man. I don't make it my business to understand symbolic dreams and things like that. But these men who are on staff with the Pharaoh, certainly seems like they could have figured this out. Grain is food. So are cows. Cows and grain are food. And that there'd be 7 fat cows, 7 fat ears of grain would suggest lots of food. Now, 7 years might not be immediately suggested, but it's not too far-fetched that someone would have thought of that. In any case, it took revelation from God. God even withheld the wise men of Pharaoh, as it turns out, from even suggesting a plausible explanation, right or wrong. If they had come up with a plausible explanation, Joseph would have never been called for. And I'm sure that the wise men were used to coming up with plausible, clever interpretations of these kinds of things. But in this case, God hindered them from even coming up with something so that Pharaoh would look further for help. Now, it says in verse 8, "Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. Then the chief butler spoke up to Pharaoh, saying, 'I remember my faults this day, when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody of the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker. We each dreamed a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream, and it came to pass just as he interpreted for us. So it happened, he restored me to my office, and he hanged him.' Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh." The mention of him shaving is simply one of those realistic touches that shows that this is a true story and would have probably been left out if it was a fiction. Joseph, of course, being a Jew, for one thing, wouldn't shave. Jews didn't shave their beards. But beyond that, he couldn't probably keep shaved in prison. He had this long growth of beard. Yet the Pharaoh and the Egyptians did shave. They shaved their faces with the exception of a little bit of a beard on their chin. But in order to stand before Pharaoh, he'd have to tidy up and shave and look more like an Egyptian, look more presentable to the Egyptian taste. So they shaved him and put on his different clothes, even though the Pharaoh was in a hurry. Probably had to bathe and all that. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I have dreamed a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said that of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it." So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace." That is an answer that will set Pharaoh's mind at rest. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river. Suddenly 7 cows came up out of the river, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then behold, seven other cows came up after him, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I have never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the seven first, the first seven, and the fat cows. When they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. So I woke. Also I saw in my dream, and suddenly seven heads came up on one stalk, full and good. And then behold, seven heads withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians, but there was no man who could explain it to me. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after them, are 7 years. And the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." That statement, the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice because it's established. There is a law in Deuteronomy that comes up called, it's a legal law about condemning a criminal. It says, "In the mouth of two or more witnesses shall every word be established." That is to say, a criminal could not be convicted on the testimony of a single accuser. There had to be at least two witnesses against him to establish the accusation as valid. That law in Deuteronomy is quoted or alluded to five times in the New Testament. Apparently it's a principle that God wishes us to be acquainted with, that if he wants to really establish something, he'll give us two or more witnesses on it. And he gave Pharaoh two witnesses, two dreams, because it was established. It's an established fact. And God wanted him to know how sure it was. Verse 33, "Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that land may not perish during the famine." Probably if this had been almost any other land than Egypt, you couldn't store food safely for 7 years. You could now, because we have ways of vacuum packing it or freeze-drying things or putting in some kind of gases in the sealed containers that keep it from rotting or whatever. In the ancient world, at least, for instance, if they were in this part of the world, in Oregon, without modern technology, they probably couldn't keep the grain from rotting or getting mildew and so forth because of the dampness. But Egypt's one of the driest places in the world. In fact, they have found grain in Pharaoh's tombs in modern times. They've discovered ancient Pharaoh's tombs that had grain buried with them, and the grain's still good. They could still sprout it when they found it. It's so dry that it wouldn't rot or mildew there. So they were able to store up 7 years worth of grain easily without the likelihood of it being ruined by moisture, being as it was in such a dry climate. Now, Joseph has suggested putting a man in charge. Now, whether Joseph was hinting, that he would make a good candidate or not, we don't know. It's possible that at this point, Joseph began to see the opportunity for his dreams that he had had to come true. That if Pharaoh would appoint him in a position of authority, that would certainly set the stage for the fulfillment of God's dreams that Joseph would be bowed down to by his family someday, or would be looked up to, which dreams must have seemed for the past 12 years that he'd been in Potiphar's house or in prison very much like something that could never happen. I mean, when you're a slave and you figure you're there for life, then you're thrown in prison, you figure you're there for life. I guess those dreams, maybe they weren't from God. although maybe he did know they were from God, and maybe he was just hanging on by faith to the promise of God that he was going to someday see this realized. Maybe that's what kept him cheerful in the jail, that he really believed that this was temporary, that there was no visible, sensible, logical way that he could ever imagine getting out of there. Yet, he had a promise from God. And he may have already at this point begun to see an inkling, if Pharaoh would appoint me to this business, it would certainly play well into the general setup for God's dreams he gave me to be fulfilled. On the other hand, of course, Joseph may not have had a concern for that position for himself when he suggested it. He may have just hoped that by making a good suggestion, the Pharaoh would grant him freedom to go home to his family. We don't know yet. I said 12 years because we later find out that Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, and he was 17 when his brothers sold him into slavery. So he'd been 12 or 13 years in Egypt. And that whole time in Egypt, he had either been a slave or a prisoner. 13 years, a long time. For God to be testing his faith there and the dreams that God had given him. Well, the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this man? A man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all the people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." Now, in this particular situation, we see one of the strongest evidences that Joseph may be a type of Christ. He goes through a period of rejection from his brothers, as Jesus was rejected by the Jewish people. He was humiliated, brought very low, because of the rejection of his brothers. And then, suddenly, overnight really, exalted to the highest position in the universe, short of that of the Father himself. He's at the right hand of the Father. Only the Father in the throne is really more in a more exalted position than Jesus, and it's hard to know even if that's measurably more exalted, because Jesus said, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me." It does say that in 1 Corinthians 15 that in putting all things under Jesus' feet, it's a given that the one who put all things under his feet is accepted. He's not under his feet. Jesus apparently is either at an equal standing with the Father or just barely subordinate, barely lower than that position of the Father, just like Joseph was with Pharaoh. And because of this, of course, Joseph became the Savior of the world and of his brethren, because Joseph's administration is that which kept everyone from starving to death during the 7 years of famine. So, first of all, he's rejected by his brethren, then he suffers deep humiliation and suffering, and then he is exalted suddenly to the right hand of Pharaoh, as it were, the most powerful man in the world, comparable to Jesus being at the right hand of God in his sphere, and then becoming from that position the savior of the world, really, from their starvation. That certainly looks a lot like a parallel to the career of Jesus. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. Now, this signet would be used for stamping seals on official documents. The Pharaoh's signet, you probably know that kings would wear a ring with a distinctive impress on it. And when they would send out an official document, in order for it to have official standing, they'd seal it with a bit of molten wax, and they'd stick their ring in the wax and lift it out, and the wax would quickly harden, and it would bear the signet of the king. And that seal of the king would prove that this was officially binding. Well, the king gives Joseph his ring so that Joseph can send out documents, can make decrees, whatever, and seal them with the authority of the Pharaoh. He's given carte blanche. He's given all authority from the Pharaoh to act in Pharaoh's place. Again, corresponding quite closely to the role that Jesus occupies with reference to the Father. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put on a gold chain around his neck, just probably the trappings of royalty and prestigious position. And he had him ride in the second chariot, which he had. That's because Pharaoh rode in the first, no doubt. And they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. So every knee had to bow to Joseph. And every tongue confess that he was in charge of things. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, which is obviously an Egyptian name, and it means God speaks and he lives. And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Now this is maybe a little unfortunate, just because he had to marry a pagan. Not only a pagan, but the daughter of a pagan priest. Probably a priest of the god Ra, sun god, or some other one of the pagan deities. So Joseph married a pagan woman, although that doesn't mean that she retained her pagan convictions, or ever had them, for that matter. She may well have become a believer in Jehovah, too. The Jews were not supposed to marry outside their religion. But it was okay if they married outside their race, so long as the person they married had converted to their religion. And this may have been the case with this woman. Of course, Joseph was not in the position to say yay or nay about this. He didn't choose this wife. He didn't even choose necessarily to be married, but he was given a wife. Likewise, Jesus got a bride among the Gentiles when he was rejected by his brethren, the Jews, and he was therefore sent among the Gentiles, and that is where his bride was taken, in among the Gentiles. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the 7 plentiful years the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. Now it says all the food. It has to be understood in light of verse 34. This means really a fifth of all. It doesn't mean all the food. They had to eat some. They had to replant some every year. But they took a fifth of it, as he had suggested back in verse 34, and laid it up. And that's the food that he collected. So the expression all the food in verse 48 has to be understood in the context of verse 34, which is something I call to your attention, not because I thought you'd be having problems with it. You might not have even noticed the problem. But because it is a good example of things we'll find elsewhere in Scripture where the word all is used, not in the absolute universal sense, but many times in the context it means all of something of a certain category, or even just the vast majority of something. So he did this, and Joseph gathered very much grain, verse 49, as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was without number. And to Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of the famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, which means making forgetful. For God has made me forget all my toil in all my father's house. He'd given up any ideas of going back home to his father's house. And that would take something. God, in other words, God had given him a better deal so that he no longer longed to go back to his father's house. And since he had such great longing for so long to do so, it just means that God has really given him something really great, something so much better than what greater than the desires of his heart, so that he even forgets. He's put it out of his mind, going back to his father's house. And the name of the second son he called Ephraim, which means fruitfulness, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Now Manasseh and Ephraim later became tribes in Israel. We'll explain how that happened when we get to chapter 48. They were sons of Joseph, but they became sons of Jacob, and therefore they became the heads of tribes, as the other sons of Jacob did. This by adoption. In chapter 48, Jacob adopted them. Then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended. And the 7 years of famine began to come. As Joseph had said, the famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, and the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do. Interesting. Remember when the servants at the wedding feast in John chapter 2 came to Mary and said, They're out of, actually, I don't know how she found out. She probably heard from servants. She came to Jesus and said, they're out of wine. And he basically put her off and said, well, you know, what business is that of mine? It's not my hour. But she turned to the servants and said of Jesus, whatever he tells you to do, do. That's what Pharaoh told the people when they were out of food to Joseph. Whatever he tells you to do, do. And by the way, when people come to God seeking salvation, seeking the bread of life, God will invariably direct them to Jesus. I don't know what exactly is to be done about people who never hear about Jesus. But I will say this, that those who know about Jesus to worship God, whether they're Muslims or Jews or whatever, they may be very, very sincere. But if they were really coming to God, he would tell them, go to Jesus. I just can't believe that people are as sincere as they should be. If they are worshiping God as they think sincerely, and they know about Jesus, but they're rejecting Jesus. God, if he is in communication with these people, would certainly tell them, go to Jesus, just like Pharaoh said, go to Joseph. You hungry? Go talk to Joseph. Do whatever he says. He's the Lord here. He's the one that I've appointed to be the Savior of the people and to be your Lord. Notice, go to Joseph for food so he can save your lives and do whatever he says. He's your Lord too, Savior and Lord. The famine was all over the face of the earth. That would, of course, have to be taken within the context of the Middle East probably too, or the Mediterranean world. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became very severe in the land of Egypt, so that all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe in all lands. I only want to point out that the expression, all the face of the earth in verse 56, and verse 57, all countries and all lands. It should not be thought that there were aboriginals from Australia coming, or the Navajos from North America, or the Mayas, or the Incas from Latin America were coming. Obviously, this all lands and all countries is to be understood within the framework of a certain delimited area. And the reason I point it out is not to be not to deal with trivial matters, but because there are many times in Scripture, especially in prophecy, that talk about things that pertain to all nations and all lands and all the world and all the earth, where in fact a consideration of context often will point to not the whole world. And we would read, because we have the conception in the 20th century, we know about the whole world. And when we read all the earth or all the world, we assume it means the whole globe, the whole planet. And by the way, I think this has a lot to do with interpreting Revelation correctly also, because there's a lot of stuff about all the earth and all the world and all peoples in Revelation. But I would at least suggest that you keep an open mind that there may be expressions like this that refer not to what we know as the whole world, but what the readers knew as the whole world, what was communicated to them. In the case of Revelation, possibly the whole Roman Empire, or the whole Roman world. We know that Caesar Augustus decreed in Luke chapter 2, verse 1, that all the world should be taxed. Caesar didn't have the power to tax the whole world as we know it. He didn't even know it was there. But he did tax the whole Roman Empire, and yet that's called the all the world in Luke 2, 1. And so, just become aware of biblical language, because as you study the prophets especially, you'll have to make decisions at times whether you find, when you find all countries, all nations, all lands, whether in the context it's talking about, you know, everyone on the planet or simply all the lands within a certain range of consideration. In this case, I think it's likely that it was not the whole planet, since I doubt if people in China came to Egypt to get food on this occasion. They probably starved to death on their way there if they did, because so far. Chapter 42, now the plot thickens. When Jacob, whom we haven't heard anything about since chapter 36, practically, or 37, Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? I wonder what that meant. They're starving to death, they're eyeing each other. You still got a lot of meat on you. We could eat you this week, and you could eat me next week. How's that sound? And Jacob says to his sons, why do you look at one another? And he said, indeed, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy it for us there, that we may live and not die. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. 10? Yes, because it says in verse 4, Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. Now it seems obvious. Rachel only had two children, Joseph and Benjamin. She was the only wife Jacob ever cared about, and probably those were the only two sons he ever cared about. And Joseph was now, as he thought, dead. And it seems obvious that Benjamin by this time had occupied in his father's affections the same place of favoritism that Joseph had once held. And that is significant to the meaning of some of Joseph's dealings as we read on here. So Benjamin is not sent, but the other 10 go to get food. Now, of course, they don't even know Joseph is alive, much less that he's ruling in Egypt. They're just going to buy food, and they know nothing of what's about to happen or its significance to them. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now, Joseph was governor over all the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. Now, I doubt if Joseph personally interviewed everyone who came asking for, you know, a few sacks of grain. I mean, there were no doubt tens of thousands of people, possibly every day, showing up starving and needing food. But he was in some sense overseeing it. He probably had a lot of subordinates, you know, who were dealing with cases. Probably it was a situation where certain cases were brought to his attention. He'd move around and supervise and listen in on the conversations of some of the agents that were dealing with people, so that Joseph was not in some ivy tower somewhere delegating everything. He was actually down where the food was being distributed. Of course, it can't be that everyone had to talk to him personally, because there just wouldn't be time for him to talk to everybody who needed food and to interview each case. So he must have been supervising the agents who were interviewing the people and so forth. So he had a chance when his brothers... He was probably looking for his brothers, to tell you the truth. I mean, now that he was chief in Egypt, and 7 years of plenty had gone by, and now a year of famine had gone by, it's been 8 years since he's been elevated to position. And he's had 8 years to think about how this position might end up in the fulfillment of the dreams that God gave him about his brothers bowing down to him. I'm sure in 8 years, a smart guy like Joseph figured out, hey, they're going to have to come here and get food. I'm going to watch for him. I'm going to see him. I'm going to see this dream fulfilled. And so he was down there among the people who were coming to get food, because he probably was expecting his brothers to show up. Furthermore, he, I believe it can be shown, had a plan, a specific plan. He didn't act impulsively when they came. He knew exactly what he planned to do, and he had a reason for it, which we'll talk about later on. So, Joseph was, it was he who sold to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. So it's exactly as he dreamed they would. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. Then he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Now, why didn't they recognize their own brother? Well, that's easy enough. First of all, he was 17 when they saw him last. Now he was 38. He was over twice as old as when they'd last seen him. He was a middle-aged man, probably, you know, let's see, 38, probably wasn't graying yet or anything like that, but in all likelihood, you know, he had probably had a Pharaoh-like little square beard and the rest of his face shaved, where probably at 17 he had probably had a beard fully covering most of his face. He would have matured a great deal. Even if he hadn't, I've often gotten to a place where after not seeing someone for 10 years even, you know, when I see him again, I think, who is that again? I mean, I kind of look vaguely familiar, but I don't remember who they are. Especially if they thought Joseph was dead, and it was the last place they expected to see him. Even if there was something about him that looked vaguely familiar, it would be the last thing they'd consider. Oh, this is Joseph, you know, and looking different, speaking a different language. We find that he spoke to them through an interpreter, so that they wouldn't know that he could understand them when they spoke. They spoke, of course, Hebrew to each other, but he spoke Egyptian. And all the conversations between them that we read of that took place initially were through an interpreter, we find. So they didn't recognize his language or his face or his age, certainly. And they didn't expect to ever meet Joseph, so it never occurred to them that that's who it was. Then Joseph remembered the dreams, verse 9, which he had dreamed about them. And he said to them, you are spies, you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are all honest men. They're right about one of those two things, but not about both. Your servants are not spies. But he said to them, no, but you have come to see the nakedness of the land. A Hebraism or a Middle Eastern expression. It means try to spot where the land was vulnerable to attack. The nakedness of the land would be where it's not well covered, it's not well armed, where perhaps people of their land could come and invade. Now what they're saying is, no, we don't represent any nation or any government that could threaten you. We're just the sons of one man. We're just a small family. Far from being, you know, agents of some foreign government, we're just a minor, you know, clan wandering around nomadically on the face of the desert. We're just honest men, all one man's sons. But he said to them, no, you have come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more. Of course, meaning Joseph. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying you are spies. In this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, you are spies. Now, so he put them all together in prison for 3 days. When you first read this story of how he treated his brothers, it may raise questions in your mind. What was he doing? Why did he treat them this way? Was he just getting back at them? Was he just angry? He thought, well, now it's my turn. You know, I was at your mercy, now you're at my mercy. It's revenge is sweet. Now, I'll tell you what. If he was just interested in revenge and getting back at them and give them a taste of their own medicine, as it were, it would have been much more sweet a revenge to tell them, I'm Joseph. Right off. I'm Joseph, and look what I can do to you now. You know, I'm the guy you threw in the pit. Remember, I'm the guy you sold. Remember when I cried out and begged for mercy and you didn't? Guess what? You are at my mercy, and I am the most powerful man in the world. I mean, that would make revenge very sweet. But he didn't tell who he was. He kept them in suspense. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't know why this guy was picking on him. And the fact of the matter is, he wasn't just into revenge. Not in the least. As a matter of fact, later on we read that he had no animosity toward them at all. He saw that although they had treated him badly, they had been the agents of God in getting him where he should be and so forth. He didn't bear them any grudges. So why did he treat them so rough? There is a reason. And the closest thing that we get to an answer to why he did it is right here in verse 16, where he says, you shall be kept in prison that your words may be tested to see whether there's any truth in you. Joseph had thought of a very elaborate plan by which he could discern whether his brothers were good men now or not. He hadn't seen them for 18 years or whatever it was, 21 years. What's it been, 8 years plus 13? 21 years. He hasn't seen them. And therefore, he doesn't know, are these the same scoundrels they were 21 years ago, or have they had a mending of their ways? Have their attitudes changed? Well, he's going to find out, and he's going to find out in an ingenious manner. You see, what he actually plans to do is to orchestrate a situation where his brothers will eventually be in exactly the same position with Benjamin as they were once at with him, where they're with him, away from their father, where the father's not there to protect him. And assuming, Joseph must have assumed by this time that Jacob loved Benjamin as he once loved him, and that the brothers probably were jealous of Benjamin, just like they were jealous of Joseph. And he was going to put Benjamin 100% at their mercy to see if they would do to him what they had done to Joseph, or if they had changed and would do differently. And this would be his way of deciding whether they had repented or not, whether there was any truth in them now. They were wicked, deceitful men when he last knew them. But now he's going to test them. Now, they don't understand the test, and even a lot of Christian readers don't understand the test. It's just confusing. Why did Joseph put the cup in the sack and do all these strange things he did? Well, it's all really ingenious, because what he did is manipulate situations so that eventually Benjamin
was in precisely the same vulnerable position to be given up as a slave in Egypt by his brothers, if they would do it. But we find, to his delight and to ours, that they were not the same men that they had been 21 years before this. We'll see. Anyway, he put them in prison for 3 days to get them shaken up a little bit, to make them feel really nervous. Them being nervous and scared was a very important part of his plan to work. Then Joseph said to them the third day, "Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go carry your grain for the famine of your houses and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "We are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we," meaning Joseph, "for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, saying, "Did I not speak to you, saying, 'Do not sin against the boy'? And you would not listen. Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us." But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. And he turned himself away from them and wept. Then he returned to them again and talked with them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So initially, 3 days before he put them in prison, he says, "I'm going to keep you all here and send one of you back to get your brother." Then he changes mind. He says after 3 days, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll just keep one of you here and send the rest of you back. You got to carry your grain to your father. And so I'll just keep one of you here." And he bounds Simeon. I'm not sure why he picked Simeon, but Simeon, we know, and Levi were both very bloodthirsty men. Simeon may have been one of the chief guys who had been instrumental in plotting originally to kill him, a plan that never materialized, but Simeon certainly would be one of the killer types among his brothers. Anyway, he actually bound Simeon before their eyes, just for the effect, so they have a good visual image. Here's our brother in chains, a free man until now, a free man in a wealthy family, but now he's in chains in a prison in Egypt. And keep that image in your mind, boys, as you go back, because you're going to be next if you're not telling the truth. I want to see your younger brother. Now, it's interesting that the brothers immediately in their mind associated this as a judgment coming upon them because of what they'd done to Joseph 21 years earlier. They said, "It's because of what we did to Joseph this is happening to us." I mean, they didn't know he was Joseph. They just felt like this was poetic justice. This was somehow God in heaven was now getting back to them, striking back at their wickedness. And you can see they must have borne the guilt of this on their conscience prominently. I mean, sometimes when sins fade into the past, you kind of forget them. But the fact that as soon as things go wrong for them, they say, "I know what this is. It's because of what we did to Joseph 20 years earlier." I mean, you know that, you know, if the first thing in your mind is, it's happening. They must have for 20 years been thinking something bad's going to happen to us. I mean, they're bearing the guilt prominently, consciously on their minds that they deserve something bad to happen to them. As soon as 20 years later something actually does happen to them bad, they say, "That's it. It's because of what we did to Joseph. It's finally come upon us." Then Reuben says, "I told you not to do this." And just hearing his brothers talk like this among themselves, they not knowing that he can understand, it just moves him to tears. And so he finds a place to go off and weep. He resisted the temptation to disclose who he was. It would have spoiled his whole plan if he had told them who he was at this point. Then Joseph gave a command to fill the sacks with grain and to restore every man's money to his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. Now, they didn't know that the money was put back in their sacks yet, but he restored the money to them. So they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give money, give the donkey feed in the encampment, he saw the money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, "My money has been restored, and there it is in my sack." Then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, "What is this that God has done to us?" Now, the reason that they were afraid at this point, apparently, was that they felt like either this was a trap. I mean, how else would the money... He was obviously a man who, for some reason or other, was disposed to find fault with them, to suspect them. They had done nothing to give the impression they were spies, and yet he just picked them out and said, "You're spies." And they weren't. He was suspicious of them beyond measure and seemed to pick them out as people to pick on. And they apparently thought, well, maybe he put this money in there just so he could accuse us of stealing the grain. Since we bought it, honestly, the only way that he could accuse us of stealing is if he didn't have our money, if we had it. And so they didn't know what to think. What's going on here? Why is this money here? They just knew it was weird, and they figured, you know, this is something God was bringing on them, a judgment. And they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan and told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man who is lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, 'We are honest men. We're not spies. We are the 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is with our father this day in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, 'By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine of your households and be gone. And bring your youngest brother to me, so I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you may trade in the land.' Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid." It was just too strange. It just seemed too weird. And they were afraid that this was an omen of a bad treatment they were going to get when they went back. "And Jacob, their father, said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin away. All these things are against me.'" Now notice it says, "You, brothers, have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more." Notice he seemed to accuse them. Although the official story was that Joseph's coat was found with blood on it, and allegedly a wild animal must have gotten him. But in the 21 years since then, he must have noticed the guilt that was animated these men. Probably whenever Joseph was mentioned, they acted kind of strangely in the household. They kind of probably looked at each other knowingly, wondering, is it going to come out of the bag? Jacob was a crafty man himself. He could read between the lines. He could probably make sense of their reactions. And in all likelihood, he had concluded that they had killed Joseph. He couldn't prove it, but it seems to come out here. "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon's no more. Now you want to take Benjamin too." It sounds like he is A, aware that they killed Joseph, and B, aware that it'd be very dangerous to put Benjamin at their mercy. Because Benjamin, of course, now had moved in to occupy the position in his father's heart that Joseph once had had. And the brothers, being jealous of Joseph, had killed him, or that's what Jacob must have assumed, they'd killed him. And what would prevent them from doing the same thing to Benjamin? Well, "Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, 'Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you.'" Of course, that's an irrational statement, but trying to convey how sincere he is and how much he's willing to take responsibility for this whole thing. But Jacob said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, then you would bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave." Chapter 43. Now the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when they had eaten up the grain which they had brought from Egypt, that their father said to them, "Go back, buy us a little food." And Judah spoke to him, saying, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you send our brother with us, we'll go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down. For the man said to us, You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.' And Israel said, 'Why did you deal so wrongfully with me as to tell the man whether you had still another brother?' But they said, 'The man asked us pointedly about ourselves and our kindred, saying, Is your father still alive? Have you another brother?' And we told him, according to these words, could we possibly have known that he would say, 'Bring your brother down'?" Now, we don't read actually in the earlier narrative of Joseph asking all these questions in verse 7, and it's possible that Judah is lying. All these brothers were pretty proficient liars, and he may have been lying in order to kind of take the heat off himself for having disclosed that information that got them all in so much trouble. That is, trouble with their dad, because they had disclosed that there was another brother, and their dad says, why'd you do that? That's not very nice of you to tell him that. Now my other son's in danger. And Judah may have just made up the story. So, well, he just was inquiring of all about the details of our family. And he may have lied just to take the heat off, but it's also possible that certainly more conversation took place besides that which is recorded. In the narratives of Scripture, it only records key aspects of conversations that carry the important parts of the story forward. There was more, dialogue than simply what's recorded, and there may have been these questions specifically asked by Joseph. He would, of course, be curious about such things, and he may have asked about it. Then Judah said to Israel, his father, send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I myself will be surety for him. From my hand you shall require him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. Now, surety, do you know what the concept of surety is? You find it a lot in Scripture. It's mentioned frequently, for example, in the book of Proverbs. Surety is the state of becoming responsible for somebody else's responsibilities, really. It's taking responsibility for someone else's responsibilities. It's like what a co-signer does. If you want to borrow money and the bank won't loan you money because you don't have established credit, if your parents would co-sign the loan, what they're saying is if you don't make the payments, they will. If you default on the loan, the bank will still get their money from your parents. And if your parents have good credit, the bank will probably give you the loan. Because they are saying, we will take responsibility. This is really our son's responsibility, or our daughter's, but we'll take responsibility if they default on it. And in a case like this, what he's saying is, whatever happens to Benjamin, I will take full responsibility. I'll be surety for him. Now, what actually happened, of course, at a later point, where Benjamin was in danger of being made a slave in Egypt, Judah, having become surety for him, actually volunteered to make me a slave. Let Benjamin go home to his father, but take me instead as a slave, because I've become surety for him. And so this is how Judah meant it. For if we had not lingered, surely by now we would have returned this second time. And their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down a present for the man, a little balm, a little honey, spices and myrrh, pistachio nuts and almonds. Now, even though there was a famine in the land, there were still some things growing. Trees have roots that go down deep enough that they could get water even when the crops of grain would not be able to grow. And, of course, nuts and fruits grow on trees. And some of these also could have been dried and preserved from earlier times when they were more plentiful. Honey, of course, they'd probably got wild from bees. And there, even in time of famine where you can't grow grains, there would still be flowering plants and so forth so that bees would be making honey. So these kinds of luxuries, really, these were not the staples of the ordinary person's diet, but they were nonetheless things that were available even in time of famine. And Jacob had a lot of these to take as a gift to the man in Egypt. Take double money in your hand. Take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take your brother also, meaning Benjamin, and arise and go back to the man. And may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother, Simeon, and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. Now, he realizes that I really can't say no to this deal because I'm going to starve to death, and so is Benjamin, so is everybody else if we don't get grain. So if I send Benjamin, I might lose him, but if I don't send him, we'll definitely lose him. We'll all die. So I've got to take my chances, and if I'm bereaved of my sons, I guess I've just got to live with that. I've just got to be bereaved. I've got to deal with it. It's like a similar expression that Esther used when she realized that she had no choice but to go before the king, even at a time when it might cost her head if he didn't approve. And she decided she'd do it, and she said, well, if I perish, I perish. Same kind of expression. Doesn't want to perish, but if that happens, I guess that happens. Can't really get out of the situation at this point. So the men took the present and Benjamin, and they took double money in their hand and arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my home, slaughter an animal and make it ready, for these men will dine with me at noon. Then the man did as Joseph ordered, And the man brought the men into Joseph's house. Now the men were afraid because they were brought into Joseph's house. And they said, it is because of the money which was returned in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may seek an occasion against us and fall upon us to take us as slaves and our donkeys. When they drew near to the steward of Joseph's house, they talked with him at the door of the house. Joseph wasn't home yet, but they were taken by a servant there, and so they talked to the steward, tried to feel things out and see if they were in trouble. And they said, oh, sir, we indeed came down the first time to buy food, but it happened when we came to the encampment that we opened our sacks, and there each man's money was in his mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it back in our hand, and we have brought down other money in our hands to buy food. We do not know who put the money in our sacks. But the steward said, peace be with you. Do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them. Now, when he says, I had your money, what it apparently means is, well, there's money in your sacks, but my records show that I have your money. You paid. You know, your money is, you're on record as having paid for your food, so you don't owe us anything. I have your money. God must have made up money and put it in your sacks, is what he's saying. That's not really your money in the sacks. I have your money. You've got something else. God must have done that for you. So the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet and gave their donkeys feed. And they made the present ready for Joseph's coming at noon, and they heard that, for they heard that they would eat bread there. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house and bowed down before him to the earth, again fulfilling the dream that they would bow down to him, which they said, we'll never bow down to you. But again, it's happening. Then he asked them about their well-being and said, is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive? Now, the fact that Joseph asked that question here makes it the more likely that he probably had asked it earlier also, a year earlier when they were there, as Judah reported that he did. Very same question. And they answered, your servant, our father, is in good health. He is still alive. And they bowed their heads down and prostrated themselves. Then he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your younger brother of whom you spoke to me? Benjamin would have been over 20 years old now. Remember, because Joseph's been away from home for more than that, 22 years now, because this is a year later than the first time. So Benjamin's going to be over 22 years old because he was born before Joseph was sold. And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Now his heart yearned for his brother. So Joseph made haste and sought somewhere to weep. And he went into the chamber, his chamber, and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out and restrained himself and said, serve the bread. So they set him in a place by himself and then by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, for that's an abomination to the Egyptians. So they sat at separate tables because the Egyptians had a prejudice against Hebrews and wouldn't eat with them. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth, and the men looked in astonishment at one another. Now, what this means is Joseph had place settings for each of the boys, and when they all sat down in their appointed place, they looked and they noticed, do you realize that we are in order of our age? That we have been seated in the exact order of our age? Now, there's 11 men, and they were all born within 7 years of each other. So some of them were almost exactly the same age. And none of them were only Benjamin was very different in age. And yet somebody, it just seemed freakish that, of course, Joseph knew who was born first and who, you know, even if some were just a few months apart in age, they were all seated in order of their age, and they looked around and they were astonished. They didn't know what to make of it. Weird things were happening all the time with them in connection with this trip to Egypt. Then he took servings for them from before him, but Benjamin's serving was 5 times as much as any of theirs. So they drank and were merry with him. So he gave Benjamin a lot more, partly, of course, to arouse jealousy if it was present in them, to see, you know, he's being treated with deferentially, just like Joseph used to be. And if they're going to be jealous, let's bring it to a head if we can, so we can see it revealed. Chapter 44. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of of the sack of the youngest and his grain money. So he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning dawned, the men were sent away, they and their donkeys. And when they had gone out of the city, and they were not yet afar off, Joseph said to his steward, "Get up, follow the men, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid evil for good? Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks, and with which he indeed practices divination? You have done evil in so doing.'" Now, whether Joseph actually really practiced divination or not, we don't know. But people in high positions in pagan lands often would have an ornamental cup, which would be ostensibly for that purpose. Usually they'd probably put grains or bits of gold dust on top of wine and interpret the configurations of that the gold dust would take, sort of like tea leaf reading or something like that. Joseph may or may not have ever practiced divination with it, but it was there for that purpose, part of the trappings of his royal household. So he overtook them, and he spoke to them these same words. And they said to him, "Why does my Lord say these words? Far be it from us that your servant should do such a thing. Look, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever you of your servants it is found, let him die, and we will all be my Lord's slaves." That was a rash statement. In view of the fact that so many things had happened they couldn't explain, they should have been a little more cautious, knowing, I wonder if the cup is in one of these sacks. But they were indignant. I think their nerves were stretched to the limit, and just being falsely accused like this just made them explode in indignation. And he said, "Now also let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my slave, and you shall all be blameless." In other words, you said, "Kill the man, and the rest of you be slaves." Nah, the rest of you can go free. Whoever has it can just be a slave. We won't even kill him. We'll just take him as a slave. Then each man speedily let down his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. So he searched, and he began with the oldest. Of course, the tension would mount with each sack, since Benjamin was at the opposite end of that line. And he left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Now, when the cup was found in Benjamin's sack, the brothers were in the crucial position to decide what will they do. They've just been told, whoever has the cup will be a slave in Egypt, the rest of you can go home free. They could have, if they had not repented of their treatment of Joseph, if they were not changed men, they could have said, "Well, Benjamin, you should have not done that. Poor Dad, he's going to lose another one. Well, we'll just go home, tell Dad we couldn't do anything about it. Benjamin apparently stole a cup. He got himself in trouble. He's a slave in Egypt." They had sold Joseph into Egypt just as heartlessly as that. And now, if they had the same jealousy toward their father's new favorite, Benjamin, they were certainly in a position, without any blame to themselves, to surrender Benjamin also, to bring grief on their father as they had before, but heartlessly. But, I mean, they could say, "Well, this is not our problem. This is Benjamin's problem. What can we say?" I mean, here's a case where they could actually abandon Benjamin to the same fate they had abandoned Joseph to, only this time without any fault to themselves. Would they? That's what the whole test was calculated to determine. But we find them acting better in this case. In verse 13, "Then they tore their clothes, each man loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city." Instead of going, saying, "Bye, Benjamin, see you sometime, we're going home," they decided to go back and endanger their own lives with Benjamin and face this mean guy, Joseph, and plead for Benjamin's release. So Judah and his brothers, as they're called from this point on, the tribe of Judah later was the leading tribe of Israel, possibly because Judah took the lead morally. He definitely occupied the highest moral ground in this situation. Judah's words spoken here, I can hardly read without getting choked up. They're just so evident of a man who's changed so radically from his earlier life in a godly way. "They came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, 'What deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination?'" In other words, I could divine and find out who stole my cup. "And Judah said," now this is Judah speaking, he's the one who'd become surety for Benjamin, "'What shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Here we are, my Lord's slaves, both we and he also with whom the cup was found.' But he said, 'Far be it from me that I should do so. But the man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave, And as for you, go up in peace to your father. So the first offer was, Judah said, I'm not going home without him. We'll all stay here and be your slaves. Not just if you're going to have Benjamin, you're going to have us too, because we're not going back to our father without Benjamin. Then Judah came near to him and said, Oh, my Lord, please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing, and do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you are even like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, Have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, We have a father, an old man, and a child of his old age, who is young. His brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, Bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. And we said to my Lord, The lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. But you said to your servants, Unless your youngest brother come down with you, you shall see my face no more. So it was, when we went up to your servant, my father, that we told him the words of my Lord. And our father said, Go back and buy us a little food. But we said, We cannot go down if our youngest brother is not with us. If our younger brother is with us, we will go down, for we may not see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, You know that my wife bore me two sons. And the one went out from me, and I said, Surely he is torn to pieces. And I have not seen him since. But if you take this one also from me, and calamity befalls him, you shall bring down my gray hair with sorrow to the grave. Now therefore, when I come to your servant my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, that he will die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant our father with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety, meaning I became surety for the lad to my father, saying, If I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. Now therefore please let your servant, meaning me, remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up to his brothers with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father? Chapter 45. Then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, Make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians in the house of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, Please come near to me. And they came near, and he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Hasten to go up to my father and say to him, Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord over all Egypt. Come down to me. Do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen. You shall be near me, you and your children, your children's children, and your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, lest you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 more years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt and of all that you have seen, and you shall hasten and bring my father down here. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Moreover, he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, and after that, his brothers talked with him. We're not going to take this chapter any further in this session because we'll run out of time if we try to. I just want to point out how powerful this scene is when he reveals who he is to his brothers. Because they have already been made incredibly nervous around him. I mean, he's shown them a taste of what he can do. Throw them in jail for 3 days. Just have them totally at his mercy. And now he says, I'm Joseph. And they remember. And they're feeling guilty already. You know, about, they're still feeling guilty 22 years later about what they did to Joseph. And now he says, I'm Joseph. And they don't know what he's going to do now. He hasn't been all that nice to them up to this point. And maybe this is just the coup de grace, you know. He said, I'm Joseph, and that's why I'm going to cut your heads off now, you know. But instead, and they're dismayed at his presence. They can't speak. And, of course, he's merciful to them, and they must have been relieved at that. However, they must have thought, wait, we got to go tell Dad that Joseph is ruling in Egypt. This is going to be a little difficult, isn't it? I mean, aren't we going to have to admit that Joseph, I mean, if we don't admit what we did to Joseph, Dad's going to meet Joseph. Joseph will tell him. You know, these guys are going to have to fess up to their dad now for the first time. And that's not going to be easy. That they've been deceiving their father for 20 years. That they allowed their father almost to die of grief. And they stood around hypocritically trying to comfort him when they could have told him the truth. But I mean, the truth has come home to roost for them. They're not going to suffer as badly as they deserve to suffer. But they're going to have to fess up. They're going to have to come clean. They're going to have to face their father. And they face Joseph. But still, it must have been an incredible thing for them to realize this man that they were so intimidated by was their brother who owed them something in terms of retribution. But at this point, it's showing very clearly he had no intention of giving it. Later in their lives, they still weren't sure. They weren't sure if he was just being nice to them to please his father at this point. But when the father died, they thought he might take his wrath out on them. But we'll see that later on. Of course, they misjudged him entirely. We'll stop there for now, and we'll pick it up again right where we left off after we take a break.